You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The 2020 presidential campaign was a defining moment for America and for the Democratic Party. As author Edward Isaac DeVere writes in his new book, Battle for the Soul, inside the Democrats' campaigns to defeat Trump, there were backroom battles and public battles as well as the 24 Democratic presidential candidates fought for the nomination. DeVere traveled with the campaigns of several candidates, including the campaign of President Joe Biden. In the book, DeVere tells the stories of the long two-year campaign. He also got to know a lot about the post-President Barack Obama era. The author says Obama told many in the Democratic Party he was thoroughly disturbed by the actions of President Donald Trump.
That Obama was watching what was happening and really upset about it. And that the moments that I have where he's using this language, for example, he refers to Trump at one point as a corrupt MF-er, and it's because he's looking at the fact that Trump is getting on phone calls with foreign leaders without any aides listening in, which is really not the way the protocol of this is, that he's got the Russian ambassador meeting with him in the Oval Office, and nobody else is in there, nobody was happening. And Obama is basically like, what is going on? What is he doing? Which I think is a reaction that a lot of people had. And you see with Obama a pretty intense reaction to that that comes out in those words, but comes out also just the tone that he has and the frustration that he has.
You know, it seems to me that it, between all of the many Democratic candidates, of course, you know, I don't know how long Iowa will have Iowa caucuses first anymore, but they were definitely through here. There was a different vibe between them. I feel like they felt they had to come out punching almost. And it was not just against Republicans, but against each other, not just here, but on the national level, especially between Kamala Harris and Biden, when she kind of went after him about racism. And the reaction you talk about in your book that, you know, Mrs. Biden had, that she felt her husband had spent his whole life fighting racism and this was not fair.
Yes. And she, again, it's another where you see the intensity of feeling coming out in the language. And she's on a call shortly after that first debate. And she says, with what he's done and the life that he's led, to stand up there and call him a racist, go F yourself. Of course, she also does not use the initial for that word. this was intense. There was a lot of intense feeling, not just about Trump, but about what the Democratic Party was supposed to be, how it was supposed to be. And that's what I track it through all of these candidates in the book and all of the ways that these campaigns were playing out. And the book is called Battle for the Soul. It could be almost like Battles for the Souls, right? All of these things are being sorted out. What does the Democratic Party believe in? What does it look like? What is its coalition? You know, is it the progressives of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren? Which one of those progressives is it? Is it a party that wants to be more traditionalist as Biden was when he got into the race? And certainly is not so much anymore, but was when he got in. Is it about going toward a more diverse coalition, a party that would be represented by Kamala Harris as the nominee, or Cory Booker or Julian Castro? Is it something that tips back to the more moderate approach that Mike Bloomberg tried to do when he got into the race? Is it about what the generational argument that Beto O'Rourke and Pete Buttigieg were making? All these things were going on. And then all of it sorting out as the country was going through everything that it was going through, even before the coronavirus hit. And then now everything in this last year and a half, almost year and a half, I guess, at this point, of the pandemic and these circumstances that have changed everything for the country, changed everything for the party, and changed everything for the presidency that Biden has in front of him.
Mm. Yeah, and it does seem like a lot of things that seemed super important before the pandemic sort of switched around. It changed everything. And when I look at sort of how the Biden administration has gone forward, and in some ways very carefully, you know, putting out certain things and ideas, but then in other ways going forward the very first day and signing executive order after executive order, taking really his, in a way, that's what Donald Trump did. with executive order after executive order saying, I'm going to put my seal on this immediately.
Yeah, there's a very fast pace to the Biden presidency so far. When I interviewed him for the book, I was 2 weeks into his presidency, and the interview is at the end of the book. It was right as he was about to sign the executive orders, rescinding the Trump executive orders on immigration policy. So he got off the phone with me. He said, okay, well, all right, I've got to go and go do this. We're running a little bit late. So that's the way it went. But I think you see here when he and I were talking, he pointed out to me that he has that Franklin Roosevelt portrait hanging in the prime spot in the Oval Office. It's over the fireplace in the Oval. Some people have asked me, what do you think he might have had? What portrait might he have had other than FDR in sort of the presidency that he imagined when he got into the race? I'm not sure what that answer is. I feel like it might be more Harry Truman than FDR. But he saw his presidency as being about almost like a reset of giving, he saw Trump as a wound essentially to America, a big gash, and that he would give time to like for the wound to close up and not be aggravated anymore. He knows that his presidency is in part a function of Barack Obama, that Obama elevated him to be vice president, gave him it was part of that administration, and then gave him that connection to Black voters, which was so important in the primary campaign that has much to do with how he ended up being the nominee. Biden also knows that his presidency is obviously a function of Donald Trump, right? That he was a lot of people turned to him in the primary race because they thought he's the one who's most likely to be able to beat Donald Trump. And that there was a reaction to Trump that was powering him through then into the general election too. He knows those things, but as I read in the book, he is determined to not let that be his only place in history now, and to really have this presidency stand out. And you see that in how he is going about the job day to day now, these days.
Mm. How do you think his whole tabloid-esque situation with his son has played into this? Because I remember this whole thing, it's almost hard to remember back to the whole the very first the first impeachment thing about Russia, Ukraine, and all that was going on, and reading in here about how Hunter Biden had thought about doing a TV show about his family. I mean, was that like on top of all? It seems crazy, like a crazy idea.
Biden, to understand him, you have to understand his relationship to his sons, to both Hunter and to Beau, because Beau was the Delaware Attorney General. There was a lot of expectation that he would be the governor and eventually run for president. Biden saw him as to track back, of course, the two boys are the children from his first marriage, his wife, who was killed in that terrible car accident a couple of weeks after Biden is elected to the Senate, that also kills his baby daughter, and the two boys end up in the hospital. Biden raises them as a single father for a few years, and then gets married to now Jill Biden, and they have another child together, a daughter. But the bond that he had with his sons was intense for obvious reasons. And so Beau grows up and he's the star. He's the guy who is just everything kind of goes right for. And having spent time with him, it came off of him like the way that those leading politicians do. And then he develops this brain cancer, this terrible brain cancer that kills him in a horrific way and also very quickly. And when he dies Memorial Day weekend of 2015, at his funeral, Barack Obama refers to him as Joe Biden 2.0. So there was this general sense that, okay, that's what Beau Biden is going to be. Joe Biden had at that point basically given up on running for president, and he had transferred the dreams to Beau. He was going to be there basically at his son's inauguration, that Joe Biden III, that's what Beau's full name was, that Joe Biden would be the president. But when Beau dies, Biden thinks about getting in 2015 to the 2016 race. And then you see that Beau continues to be a presence in his life in every which way, even in death. Remember, there was that moment in one of the debates with Trump when Biden was accused of wearing a microphone on his wrist. That was like, what is that device? And it was Beau's rosary that he was wearing. On election day, he goes to Beau's grave and spends some time there just with Beau. But all of this relates to your question about Hunter, because Hunter was not the star. Hunter was the younger brother, slightly younger than Beau, but was always kind of trading off his father's name and leading a life that was about being a Joe Biden's son, getting a lot of jobs from that, and being at a lobbying firm, and always struggling. Of course, we know about his addiction problems as well. And that was another struggle that Hunter was going through. But Hunter getting mixed up in these situations, I refer in the book to that Joe Biden had a sort of willful naivete about Hunter, that he was like, I hope you know what you're doing, okay. You know, there's like, and that's a big part of who Joe Biden is too. That of course leads to trouble as Hunter gets into trouble. Biden said about Hunter doing that work at Burisma, that Ukrainian company, I hope you know what you're doing. I think most people look at that and say, should the vice president's son have been getting on the board of an energy company in Ukraine? Should he have been doing that, especially as his father was doing work in Ukraine? Most people would say that that seems a strange decision, right? But that doesn't mean that it was the corrupt decision that Donald Trump was trying to make it out to be. Joe Biden was not involved in any of that stuff. But nonetheless, it caused enough trouble that it leads to Trump making that phone call to the Ukrainian president and that snowballs into that first impeachment. And the great irony of this that I trace in the book is that that comes at a moment for Biden's campaign when he is really struggling and in huge trouble as a primary candidate. But Trump, who's scared of Biden as an opponent and is doing this to try to squash him, inadvertently elevates Biden. And now the whole Democratic Party feels like they have to protect Biden and stand by him. And even his opponents are saying, oh, well, it's bad to attack Biden. We all can be there, leave his son alone. And all these things that are going on, perfect for a campaign that was struggling. They got a lot of free press. And they also got this sense that clearly Trump was frightened of him. And Biden started talking about that a lot on the trail. And that helps reset and transform the campaign.
This whole thing has been so crazy. I guess looking forward, so I'm kind of wondering what's going to happen in the midterms now.
I don't think we know. I think it's a little bit early out. I mean, I would say to you, the 2010 Tea Party wave, which obviously had a definitive effect on politics, is something that the first inklings that we had of it were in August of 2009 when Congress went home for recess. And there were all these town halls that were becoming protests against Obamacare. And that's when it was like, oh, there's some pushback in the country then. And then you have in 2009, also importantly, governor's races in New Jersey and Virginia that are often seen as bellwethers that went for Republicans. That leads into what happened in 2010. So if you track it in a similar schedule for now, we're still at least a few months out from that. And that was early, right? That tide started to be clear. I do think that what happens for Biden is almost completely tied up in what happens with the pandemic. If a year from now, we're still living with the pandemic because somehow there's been a problem with the vaccines or because variants have spiked or whatever happens that leads to an infection rate going high and a lockdown continuing, that's going to be big trouble for Biden. And the two things that are part of that, importantly also, are where the economy is and whether schools are open in a normal way. If those are in good shape, that's much better news for Biden than if they're in bad shape. That's not the whole story, though, of course, and there are a lot of historical trends of people usually voting against the incumbent party, the party of the incumbent president in the midterms, that wouldn't be good news for Biden. Then there's some things of gerrymandering that are probably going to give Republicans a leg up in what these House districts look like.
That was author Edward Isaac Dover. His new book is called Battle for the Soul, Inside the Democrats' Campaigns to Defeat Trump. Dover tells the story of backroom battles and public ones as well. Dover traveled with the campaigns of several candidates, including the campaign of now President Joe Biden.